Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Which state has the highest rate of child maltreatment in the country? Kentucky. In the most recent year with available data, 2019, 20,130 Kentucky children were victims of one or more forms of abuse as it's legally defined. That's enough children to replace the populations of Ashland or Winchester or Madisonville. Here to help us understand these numbers and the human toll they represent is Dr. Christina Howard, Chief of the Division of Pediatric Forensic Medicine at Kentucky Children's Hospital. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Howard.
Hi, thank you.
So when we hear the statement that Kentucky has the highest rate of child abuse in the entire country, it might be hard for many to believe. First, is this recent, or does Kentucky have some history with high rates of child maltreatment?
Well, unfortunately enough, it is actually the third year in a row where Kentucky has had the highest rate of child maltreatment in the country. And we consistently can have higher than twice the national average of victims of child maltreatment in our state.
Well, I don't want to in any way sensationalize this, but to help us fully comprehend in a human way, what can you tell us about some of the more difficult cases that you've encountered?
You know, I think that sometimes it's really hard to just imagine what some children are going through during these types of situations. But when we talk about child maltreatment, it ranges anywhere from a child being, you know, neglected by not having, you know, a winter coat in the winter. But then it goes to the extreme where children are killed as a result of child maltreatment. And of course, those emotionally are always the most difficult ones, the children that are killed or even tortured by their caregiver, somebody that is responsible for their well-being. Torture a child over a prolonged period of time is really hard to imagine as a human being.
What are the most common types of maltreatment in Kentucky?
The top forms that we talk about are physical abuse, sexual abuse, or neglect, with neglect by far being the number one highest cause of child maltreatment.
Do you think the pandemic, especially among people who are essential workers and they have to go to work, but they have kids at home from school, do you think we're going to find out once the data is crunched that we've seen a spike?
When we looked at the most recent child fatality, near fatality review, financial issues were part of 73% of those cases. And so it really concerns me when we have these types of situations where there's a large proportion of families that are in financial crisis, that is a huge stressor that can increase the number of children that are victims.
If you were to profile the most common abuser in Kentucky, who would that be?
One of the biological parents is typically the perpetrator, with the mom being the most common. We do know that overall children in single-parent homes are more likely to be victims of physical or sexual abuse than children who live with both biological parents. They're actually at 120% greater risk of being endangered by some type of child maltreatment when they're not in the home with both biological parents. And so the natural mother and natural father are by far the most common perpetrators of child maltreatment.
What about child sex trafficking? We hear a lot about that these days. How prevalent is that in Kentucky?
Well, and I think people always had that conception that child sex trafficking victims was not really an American problem. Unfortunately, in the United States, child sex trafficking is a multi-billion dollar industry. And in Kentucky, it also has that problem here in the state. We see it a lot when there's large type of events, such as the Kentucky Derby. However, in the state of Kentucky, there's also where, you know, a large area where there's means of transportation. And so people to get from one area to another, a lot of people do come through Kentucky. And so our interstate system kind of opens up a lot of victims coming through here that are victims of child sexual trafficking. Last year, for pediatrics, our DCBS investigated over 200 cases of alleged sex trafficking, And it, unfortunately, it went from age ranges of infants being victims all the way up to 17 years of age. We are definitely seeing an increase in what we call familial human trafficking because of substance abuse issues. 86 of those 200 alleged victims had some type of commercial exchange of illegal substances involved with it as well. And so as the opiate epidemic and as the illegal substance use continues to be a problem in our state, human trafficking is going to be a problem as well.
Wow, this is heartbreaking. The official data relies on reported maltreatment. Is there reason to believe that the reality is much worse than these numbers indicate?
We only get cases when it gets reported, and there's a lot that's going on that doesn't get reported, especially in this past year. Reports to DCBS decreased by 29% this past year because there's not any eyes outside of the family on a lot of these kids. And when you don't have external eyes on these children, reports unfortunately go down. And so I think for the data for this past year, we're going to see a decrease in substantiated cases, but I don't think that's anywhere close to a reflection of what's really happening.
Well, let's talk about those eyes. But who typically reports that a child is being abused or neglected? Who sees that?
Yeah, so teachers did make up a large proportion of calls into the cabinet for child maltreatment concerns. We've tried to do virtual teaching on how to recognize child maltreatment virtually, but it is very hard when you're looking at a video or, you know, a short clip of somebody on a Zoom meeting to be able to really recognize what the child is going through. And so not having those external teachers involved, childcare is another one. And there's been a lot of challenges with childcare in the past year. Daycares aren't able to have the large number of kids that they were in the past. And so parents are having to use other resources for childcare that sometimes aren't always vetted as much as we were able to with childcare centers.
Well, what if we see, not just teachers and people who are on the front lines that you just described, but any of us in the neighborhood, what if we see or become aware that a child is caught up in some kind of abusive situation? What should we do?
Yes, and I think that there have been those stories of that waitress who recognized it in her restaurant and made a report, and she saved a child. So every single one of us are responsible for safety of other children. I even talk with my 10-year-old daughter about, you know, if she has a friend that says something to her, she needs to tell me because we don't want her friend to go through something like that. And so every single person is responsible for the safety of our children. And so if there are concerns in Kentucky, we are legally obligated to call a report into the cabinet. And so that number is 1-877-KY-SAFE-1 to make a report when you have that concern.
Dr. Howard, I know that Kentucky Children's Hospital and the COSER Charities Face It movement have teamed up to promote child abuse prevention efforts in the eastern part of Kentucky. Can you tell us more about that partnership and the impact it will have on kids?
Yeah, so Face It movement initially started in Jefferson County, which is where I started some of my training as well. Then as I came to UK and started seeing a lot with eastern Kentucky and central Kentucky, we really wanted to expand what they were doing there because I think that the work that they have done has been huge. And I love the name Face It because I think that goes back to what we were saying. All of us are really the faces to end abuse. And so when I came to the University of Kentucky, I wanted to continue that partnership. And so it has expanded to now have over 100 partners across the state of Kentucky that are really interested in ending child maltreatment and neglect in Kentucky. And so they have three focuses, one of those being best practice, which is the education, the outreach, making sure that we're taking care of the children and victims as well, building the awareness, and then advocating for policies. And so bringing together experts in this field and really seeing what's going on across the state, we can't do it individually. So I think this partnership has made a huge impact in the state of Kentucky.
Dr. Christina Howard, Chief of the Division of Pediatric Forensic Medicine at Kentucky Children's Hospital. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Not only does Kentucky have the nation's highest rate of child maltreatment, Kentucky also has one of the nation's highest rates of these children who are now being raised by relatives or family friends. It's called kinship care or fictive kin care. The state recently started a new program to pay some of these caregivers, but Graham Ambrose of the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting found that the program isn't meeting the needs of thousands of caregivers and children in Kentucky.
Barry Shrout's granddaughter is 14 years old. She's always been shy, he says, but she's really starting to grow into herself. She's a talented cheerleader. He's proud of her.
She made the high school team as in the eighth grade, and the coach told me last year that she probably would have made it in the seventh grade.
Shrout is a 63-year-old single grandfather in Northeast Kentucky. He took his granddaughter in when she was four, after the girl's parents fell into drug abuse. Back then, the state had a program to pay caregivers like Shrout, who were raising the abused and neglected kids of relatives or family friends. It was called the Kinship Care Program, and it paid $300 per child per month. Not a lot of money, but enough to help pay the bills.
I don't expect to get rich off this, but I just want these kids to be able to have a somewhat normal life.
In 2013, facing a budget shortfall, the state closed that program Shrout was relying on. He was grandfathered in and kept getting the money. But 6 years later, in 2019, three more of his granddaughters came to live with him.
I didn't seek them out. They came to me.
For these three girls, he didn't qualify for the $300 payments to help raise them. The new state policies allowed him the choice to become what's called a child-specific foster parent, where he raises his grandkids but gives the state custody. That way, he'd get $350 per child per month, but he'd lose the certainty that the kids would stay with him. Shrout decided to keep custody and get less money.
They could, at any moment, could have decided that if they wanted to come and get one of them or two of them or whatever, of the last three, they could come and get them, you know. And I wasn't willing to take that chance.
Shrout says that, with their other expenses, the money he gets isn't enough to take his four grandchildren to McDonald's.
I've really got to hustle to make ends meet every month.
Shrout's decision was the same one faced by thousands of kinship caregivers, stuck with flawed options while raising someone else's kids. Kids who have suffered abuse and neglect. Kentucky has one of the highest rates of kinship care in the U.S., totaling some 77,000 children. Licensed foster parents raising strangers can make north of $800 per month for each child. That's almost three times what kinship caregivers make, if they make anything at all. And because of the patchwork of new rules and budget changes, the support payments for kinship caregivers depend entirely on what year they took a child in. Shannon Moody is a policy expert at Kentucky Youth Advocates. She says there's confusion about the law among caregivers and even state staffers.
We have groves of caregivers who call us regularly and say, I've had to take money out of my retirement. I don't know where else to go. Who were rightfully eligible for services and just were never told that they were there.
The state's made some effort to rectify this problem for people raising family members. In 2019, Kentucky legislators passed a new law and started paying some kinship caregivers again. Chris Fugit, a Republican legislator from southeastern Kentucky, said at the time that the new policy effectively reinstituted the kinship care program.
And it basically gives services that are needed to help grandparents, fictive kin, kinship care, to be able to get the services needed that would help the child along in the needs of their life.
But kinship caregivers themselves say the new program isn't meeting their needs. This new law is why Shrout would have to give up custody of his three grandkids. The law requires that kids spend time in state custody for grandparents to get money for them. The problem is most dire for grandparents who are eking by on Social Security or retirement savings. Advocates like Moody say it doesn't make sense why relatives are denied benefits simply for being related to the kids they're raising.
They are dealing with kids just as traumatized and just as difficult to raise. They're older, usually. They need more of a break.
Many of these caregivers say the solution is straightforward. They want to be paid more. But the legislature would have to agree. For the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting, I'm Graham Ambrose.
We have a star in the making in our midst. Her name is Matilda, And she's a therapy dog who works for CASA of Lexington. CASA stands for Court-Appointed Special Advocate. And she is in the running for national recognition. Joining us now is Executive Director Melinda Jameson. Welcome, Melinda.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about Matilda. What does Matilda do at CASA?
Yeah, Matilda is a true rock star. She is the only courthouse facility dog in Kentucky. So she is a trained service dog that spent 2 years in training through Canine Companions for Independence prior to being matched with us here at CASA of Lexington. But her role is largely to provide comfort to the abused and neglected children that we work with. And so in Kentucky, abused children actually have to testify in front of their perpetrator in court, which, as you can imagine, that can be incredibly traumatic. We can turn over Matilda's leash to the child, and she can go into the box with them and downstay up to 4 hours, not move, not make any noise, and be a sense of comfort for them. We recently had a 12-year-old young man who was asked to testify, and he had been physically and sexually abused by a stepfather. So he paused for a moment and thought about it and said, "Could Matilda go with me?" And we said, absolutely, and he was able to testify. He buried his face in her soft yellow fur as he talked about traumatic experiences, and that was enough for the court to get information they needed to criminally prosecute the stepfather. But Matilda also goes on home visits to see the children. If the child has to have a medical exam or forensic interview, she could go into the exam with them and provide a sense of comfort. But so she just really alleviates some concerns that kids could have and makes them comfortable, and not even just kids, Tom. It's impressive to see attorneys or bailiffs or biological parents in the court system. They see Matilda, and no one wants to upset the dog, right? So they're happy to see her, and she brings a sense of happiness and comfort.
And she is a lab retriever mix, is that right?
That is correct, a yellow one.
Uh-huh. That's a pretty good mix.
Yeah, and Canine Companions for Independence uses puppies that are bred out of California specifically for this work. And they have found that they are quite successful using lab golden retriever mixes.
So tell us about this national competition Matilda finds herself in.
Yeah, so she was nominated and is a finalist for the American Humane Hero Dog Award. And she is the only dog in her category from Kentucky, so the whole Commonwealth can get behind her. And people can vote through May 6th by visiting the direct link or going to the American Humane Hero Dog site. But if they go to casaoflexington.org, we have the direct link right on our page. And the great part, there's no cost, but if she happens to win her category, she will be featured on the Hallmark Channel this fall.
And when will we know if Matilda's been chosen for this award and that great television recognition?
We believe that we'll learn sometime shortly after May 6th when the voting closes, but we don't have an exact date. Come on, people. We can do this together. Let's get the vote out.
Melinda Jameson, Executive Director of CASA Lexington. That's Court-Appointed Special Advocates, and we really appreciate it, and we're rooting for Matilda. Thank you so much, Melinda.
Have a great day.
Coming up after the break, Kentucky Poet Laureate. It's a post held for 2 years with the mission of advocating for the literary arts. Tom Eblin talks with outgoing Poet Laureate Jeff Worley and his successor, Crystal Wilkinson. Plus,
after Derby Day, it's okay to plant tomatoes.
And why hummingbirds don't need those food supplements you've been buying.
They feed on small insects, mosquitoes, gnats, fruit flies, small spiders, and they get all the nutrients, the protein, and so on that they need from eating those insects.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Tom Musgrave with the Kentucky Arts Council. Coming up in Central and Eastern Kentucky Arts, Gateway Regional Arts Center in Mount Sterling will present its Woodsongs Cafe Live, featuring Cody Lee Meese, 7 p.m. Thursday, May 13th. For more information, visit grackentucky.org. And if you'd like to learn more about newly inducted Kentucky Poet Laureate Crystal Wilkinson, check out the latest episode of the Kentucky Arts Council's podcast, KY Artscast. Visit kyartscast.ky.gov for a complete archive of episodes. From the Kentucky Arts Council for Eastern Standard, I'm Tom Musgrave.
Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
There has been an important passing of the torch. Every 2 years, the governor appoints a Kentucky Poet Laureate, a distinguished writer who serves as the state's official poet and an advocate for the literary arts. For the past 2 years, Jeff Worley has served in the role. On April 23rd, he was succeeded by Crystal Wilkinson. Tom Eblin spoke with both and begins with Jeff Worley.
Jeff is originally from Wichita, Kansas, but he's lived in Lexington for more than three decades. A retired journalist, editor, and English professor, Jeff is the author of 10 award-winning collections of poetry. He also edited the book What Comes Down to Us, an anthology of 25 contemporary Kentucky poets that was published by the University Press of Kentucky in 2009. In April, Jeff will finish his two-year term as Kentucky's Poet Laureate, and it has been a term like no other, thanks to the coronavirus pandemic. It has been a challenging time and also an important one. One thing poets often do is help us understand and make sense of the world in which we have little control. Jeff Worley is here today to talk with us about his time as Kentucky's Poet Laureate. Jeff, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
So, Jeff, tell us a little about your time as Poet Laureate, both before the pandemic and since it began.
The first 10 months were absolutely wonderful. I did readings in workshops in high schools, universities, and libraries from Pikeville to Danville to Campbellsville to Murray and stops in between. I love that my job was to spread the news about Kentucky poets and their poems.
Well, so why do you think poetry is important in this time?
I think it's especially important in this time because for the last 13, 14 months, we are behaving uncharacteristically. We are staying away from each other. We are not interacting with each other in person much at all. And so I think poetry is important because one of the main things that it does is that it brings people together through the written word, the experiences of the poet, that hopefully the readers can share and enjoy.
Well, typically a poet laureate goes around to schools and libraries and gives readings and talks. So how did you adapt after the pandemic, put everybody on Zoom?
Well, like I say, the first 10 months were great. Universities, colleges, book clubs, libraries. And then all of a sudden, early March of last year, it just kind of ground to a halt. So there wasn't much to do other than I did a few book reviews. I did some book blurbs, a couple of readings on Zoom, which I didn't ever take to very well. And as Poet Laureate, the one thing that I could do almost daily is I have outside on my fence a poetry box, which you know all about because you built it and installed it, and you were the one who found out about such a thing happening. I guess it was on the eastern coast somewhere. So what I've been doing is placing 8 or 9 copies of a poem that I like in the box every 3 or 4 days for people to come by and read through the plexiglass and take a copy if they like. And this has been very popular in the neighborhood, I have to say, and it was something that I could do pretty much on a daily basis.
How would you recommend that others do that kind of a project?
If you're in Lexington, the easiest thing to do would be to come by 800 Aurora Avenue along the North Ashland Street, have a look at this and see how some genius put this together. Make your own poetry box, and I'd be glad to talk with anybody who wants to do this. One of the most fun things about this is we're half a block from Ashland Elementary, and not too long after I put this up, a mom was walking her daughter to school, and she stopped, and I was on the porch, and she looked up and said, "Are you the poetry guy?" And I said, well, on my good days I am. And she said, that's wonderful, that box of poems that you have out there. And I've been collecting them and turning them into my own book. So there's nothing that could have given me more pleasure than that interchange that I had with this little girl.
What inspired you to become a poet?
Really, two things came together at the same time. As an undergraduate, one of the ways that I made a little bit of money was playing folk music in bars and clubs. And I was always attracted to the songs that had the most poetic lyrics. Some early Dylan, Leonard Cohen, Gordon Lightfoot, others that I could name. And so for me, I knew there was really something really engaging and important about the lyrics. So I took a poetry course at Wichita State and took that one course. I think this was in 68. And I was really hooked. I knew this is what I wanted to do the rest of my life.
Kentucky is such a rich tradition of writers and poets. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. It's got several different histories with, well, in the Civil War, for example, well, North and South, isn't that right? In the state. Geography, I think, plays a part, because if you look at the eastern part of the state and the western part of the state, they're very different. Just the tradition of former poets in this state, it led Jim Wayne Miller, it led him many years ago to call Kentucky a writerly state. And that phrase has got some common currency out there, which I'm glad to hear.
Well, how has being poet laureate changed you as a poet and a writer?
I could say I just really enjoyed being able to be out there and talk about the Kentucky poets who have done such good work, and to point people toward books of theirs and so forth. And I hope personally what it's done is to give me some material for poems to come.
Well, good. You have a new collection you're working on?
I do. I'm working now on my new and selected poems, which I think I've pretty much gotten together. And so pretty soon we'll start peddling those around and see if anybody's interested.
All right. Well, congratulations on your two-year tenure. And we've been speaking with Jeff Worley, who's been Kentucky's Poet Laureate for the last 2 years. Jeff, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Tom Eblin also spoke with Kentucky's new Poet Laureate, Crystal Wilkinson.
Wilkinson was born in Ohio, but within weeks of her birth, moved to her grandparents' farm in rural Casey County. She wrote about her upbringing as an African-American in rural Appalachia in her award-winning book, Blackberries, Blackberries. Wilkinson has a journalism degree from Eastern Kentucky University and a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing from Spalding University in Louisville. She is a former assistant director of the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning and a member of the Appalachian Poets. Her other two major works of fiction, The Birds of Opulence and Water Street, have won many awards for their beautiful lyrical prose and powerful storytelling. In August, the University Press of Kentucky will publish Perfect Black, her first major book of poetry, which tells about girlhood, racism, and political awakening. She and her life partner, the poet and visual artist Ron Davis, were the former owners of Wild Fig Books in Lexington. Crystal is here to talk with us today. Crystal, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, congratulations on being named Kentucky's Poet Laureate. What does the honor mean to you?
Oh, it means so much. When they called me to tell me that I had been named the Poet Laureate, I burst into tears immediately. And so why? Because I have known every Poet Laureate since James Steele, moving forward to Jeff Worley, and now it's my turn. And so it's really exciting. It felt like validation as a Kentucky writer, and I was just really excited. I was very surprised, but so excited and so honored.
What are your goals for the next 2 years as Poet Laureate?
Well, of course, I'm sure the pandemic will interfere a little bit, but I have goals to talk to. I want to call my campaign, if you will, Stories Across the Bluegrass. And so I want to talk to elder writers, and I want to talk to younger writers and everybody in between. I don't want these 2 years to be about me and my work. So I'm going to start a podcast where I interview Kentucky writers of all ages and all genres, and I'm really excited about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kentucky has such a rich literary culture and has for generations. Why do you think that is?
I think writers grow here. I don't know what the seeds were. I know that my friends who live elsewhere in the country are always making note of it. And I think we also have, maybe it's our generosity, because I think that that was one thing as an emerging writer that I can say certainly shaped me as a writer, is the generosity from other writers. I think there may be other states, other commonwealths that have large numbers of writers, but I think that we really have a community here. People like Gurney Norman and James Baker Hall, Mary Ann Taylor Hall, Georgella Lyon, and the list just goes on and on of a generosity of sort of reaching back and helping other writers to come forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about your upbringing in rural Appalachian farm family. I believe you live in near Indian Creek, is that right?
In Casey County. Yeah, I lived in a very bookish home, especially for one that was a rural area. My grandmother, although she had only an eighth grade education, her parents wouldn't let her go on to school. She had an eighth grade education. My grandfather had only gotten to the third grade, but my grandmother always wanted to be a teacher. So she knew the importance of books. She read to me all the time. I could read before I even went to kindergarten or to Head Start. I was already reading on like a second grade level. So I come from a household that thought books were important. And I think after I had sort of read all the books in the house, I began to write my own poems and stories. So my grandfather was a tobacco farmer. The farm that we lived on was 64 acres. And my grandmother was a domestic worker and worked for school teachers in town, sort of cleaning house and cooking and that sort of thing. And I always describe my childhood as enchanted. I had like complete freedom to roam the knobs and the hills and sort of commune with nature and the animals and such, because by the time I came along as a grandparent-raised child, my grandparents had already sort of made their money and everything was already set up. So it wasn't like I had to work very hard. I was very spoiled.
Well, you know, so many people or so many African-American writers really have an urban background. But yet so many in Kentucky, not only just from Kentucky, but have come through here, you know, people like you and Frank Walker and Nikki Finney really have more of a rural or small town background. And how does that difference really shape your writing as compared to, say, some other nationally known Black writers?
Well, I think the landscape definitely plays a part. You know, there have been other writers. They're often older than I am. Like if you look at somebody like Ernest Gaines, who wrote about Louisiana, and Alice Walker, the previous generation that came before me. But I think the rural landscape is something that is important to me when I'm writing, and to sort of be in conflict with nature. It also provides healing. All of those things are important to me in my writing. Almost all of my books have some notion of nature, of small towns and how small town life is, because you're certainly shaped as a writer or as a poet when everyone in the community knows you and knows your family.
Mm-hmm. For people who haven't read your books, how would you describe your work and kind of what you're trying to accomplish as a writer?
I would say that my writing is pastoral from a Black perspective. That's one thing that I aim to highlight is rural Black communities. But then there's also things in my books that reach out to other parts of society, to readers. I think I focus a lot on mental health and mental illness and the ways in which we as a country don't deal with it directly, but also how individuals and families sort of fail to deal with mental health in their own communities.
Mm-hmm.
Girlhood is really important, I think, in my work.
I hope to have you back this summer when you have your new book coming out. But tell us a little bit about Perfect Black. And for someone who's been writing poetry for years and years, this is really kind of your first volume of poetry, isn't it?
Yes, it's my first volume of poetry, and it makes me really nervous. I didn't realize how nervous I would be to have sort of a volume of poems. There's some prose in that book, too, but mm-hmm. to have a volume of poems in the world, I think writing poetry requires a certain vulnerability and openness. And I guess writing fiction does too, but it seems to be more profound in poetry for me. So having those poems out in the world make me really nervous. The poems are, there's three parts in that book. And so the sort of early childhood, early girlhood in a rural place is sort of the beginning. The second part is about sort of maturation. And the third part is about a growing political consciousness.
All right. Well, congratulations again on being Kentucky's new poet laureate, and we expect to hear a lot more great things from you. Thanks again, Crystal Wilkinson, for being with us today.
Thank you.
Tom Eblin interviews on Eastern Standard are provided in partnership with the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning.
There's nothing in the world that I like better than making me a sandwich with a homegrown tomato. I'm up in the morning, out in the garden. I pick me a ripe one, don't pick a hard one.
Mac and Ann Bell Stone manage Elmwood Stock Farm's participation in the community-supported agriculture farm share program. They grow a lot of good, nutritious food at Elmwood. But we're going to zero in our focus on one item in particular, the tomato. Mac's here to answer questions I've harvested from a recent Facebook post, as well as my own, as one who not only loves tomatoes, but also cannot imagine a summer without the homegrown tomato. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Mac Stone.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
All right, let's get down to business here. Lots of questions about tomatoes. We have in-ground gardeners, we have container and raised bed gardeners among our listeners. So let's first talk about in-ground growing. This is Derby Week in Kentucky, and I've always understood this to be the time to get those plants into the ground, into the soil. Is that right, or am I too late or too early?
So we're right here in the middle of central Kentucky. We figured after Derby Day, it's okay to plant tomatoes. Last year, we did that. And then on May 9th, it got to 27 degrees here. So we actually took tomatoes out of the ground, put them back in the greenhouse for a few days, and put them back out in the field later. But yes, typically Derby Day, if you're very far south of I-64, you might could go a little earlier. If you're very far north of I-64, I'd hold off.
So what varieties of tomato do you recommend for this region?
You said there's all sorts of people that raise tomatoes in all sorts of ways. There's also thousands and thousands of varieties. We like the heirlooms, Cherokee purple. There's a Purdon purple that we like. They're a dark kind of maroon looking tomato, if you will. They're called black tomatoes and black Russian types. Black Crim is one that comes to mind. And then on the yellows, there's Mr. Stripey. I'll tell you one favorite variety. It's called Green Zebra. It's kind of green and yellow striped. They're smaller than some tomatoes, but if you close your eyes, you would swear you're eating a red, ripe tomato. It's awesome.
A lot of people ask me about watering. They wonder about overwatering or underwatering. Is there a rule of thumb, and how do you tell what to do?
There is a rule of thumb, and it is very critical, especially on tomatoes. People grow tomatoes, and then they'll get that black rotten spot right on the bottom, blossom end rot. It's technically a calcium deficiency, but it's actually a function of not enough water or non-uniform water moving through the plant. So any kind of mulching is best to get uniform watering. If you've got chips, straw, grass clippings, newspaper, plastic. We use plastic films around the base of the plant. Any kind of a mulching keeps the soil from getting too hot, but it also holds the moisture so that the plant has uniform watering between rains or between waterings.
If we're planting in ground as opposed to a container or a raised bed where maybe we've used store-bought soil, should we have our soil tested for pH balance and that kind of thing?
Sure. You need to know what you're working with. The University of Kentucky, there's an extension office in every county that does a soil test. It costs a few dollars, the way I understand it. And you adjust the pH. Of course, I'm coming at you from the organic side, and there's lots of organic ways to adjust the pH. You add calcium, just ground up limestone. It's available. Then there's also organic ways that you can add phosphorus and potassium and some of the other nutrients. Or if you're so inclined, you can use, fertilizers from the store.
So, Mac, what do tomatoes want from us? We know what we want from them, but what do they need in order to provide us with that taste and texture that makes for like a great BLT, for example?
The watering is the key, is number one. If you have a plant and you put it in the ground, the deeper you put it, the more roots, the more uniform that watering will be. But it's the balance of nutrients that makes that flavor that gives them. So I'm obviously lean towards soil-grown tomatoes because they have access to so many different nutrients in the soil.
Okay, let's go to some of those Facebook questions that I mentioned. From Jenna Baun, how do I ensure that my tomatoes aren't pithy or lacking flavor?
Again, it comes back to the watering and the nutritional of the plant itself. There are times in excessively wet weather that they're just kind of watery and not great. And if they're kind of dry, then they don't have all they need to be flavorful.
Kim Dixon wants to know, what's the easiest variety? We've talked about varieties, but what's the easiest to grow for a garden novice?
So I'm going to send a novice, and this would be good for containers, to Sun Gold Tomato. It's an orange cherry tomato, and they come in clusters. But because the fruit comes and goes quickly, it matures quickly, it's not as exposed to the vagaries of pest and disease as much as a big tomato that you watch ripen over a long period of time.
And that would probably be the kind of tomato that Jamie Clark is asking about here. He wants to know what's the best BLT tomato that he can grow in a raised bed.
So for BLT, I'm a favor of the Black Crème, Cherokee Purple. Those, to me, when you get a nice big one, you can slice it and it's as big as the bun. That's the way to go.
Uh-huh. Philip Petrowski wants to know, what are some tips to help keep crack-prone varieties from splitting?
That's back to watering. Like, we have our plants on a regimented watering schedule, and then we'll get a big rain, and then we know we've got to get out there and get them picked because there's just so much water in the soil and the plant's taking it up. So you have to watch the weather, and back to the uniform watering.
Julie Lynn Steele wants to know, what's the best way to treat the soil? So many tricks out there that she's never tried, she says. And I think we've covered that ground, but are there any particular tricks of the trade that might be interesting to know about?
Julie, if you can, try to add organic matter, add compost in the fall, cover it with leaves, let it sit. Then next year when you come in, it's going to be just deep and earthy, easy to dig. So, no, I mean, it's all about treating the soil. That's why as organic farmers, we treat the soil, and then the soil just gives us vegetables.
Okay, and our own Wendy Barnett wants to know, what's the best way to grow tomatoes in a container without them rotting, without them getting their feet wet, for example?
Yeah, being sure that there's, rocks in the bottom, the container itself drains well. You also got to watch shading. If there's more shading than you realize from trees around the patio or deck, then that can be a problem too. But good drainage in the pot when it does have too much water, but good water so that it doesn't dry out.
And how about suckers, those little sprouts that come up between the stems? Can they be made to form roots and then planted for a late season harvest?
They can. So by taking those off, it sends more energy to the upper part of the plant where the first fruit clusters are going to be. You don't have to take them off, but it helps bigger fruit on the rest of the plant if you do. And yes, when you pull them off, there's some little rooting hormones that you can kind of dip them in before you put them in. But a lot of people have success just putting those in potting soil in the greenhouse or in watching them, and they'll root pretty quickly. And sure, you got the same plant.
When we're at the farmer's market, we're checking out the tomatoes. And from your perspective behind the table there, as we're looking at your tomatoes, is it okay for us to handle them? How can we tell if a tomato is in its prime and it's the one we want?
Well, that's something that really kind of gets under my crawl. The
way I thought it might.
Tomatoes. Because they can damage. We've done so much work to get a beautiful tomato on the table, and then they bruise it by checking its firmness.
Uh-huh.
So to check its firmness, you can kind of rest it. You don't pick it up, but you sort of rest your hand over the tomato, and the whole palm of your hand touches the tomato. You don't use your thumb and your finger to poke it. That's kind of acceptable, but it still makes me nervous that you're going to poke it and expect it. So here's what I think what we do. We need to pick them a couple of days early so that we can get them to the market so that by the time you get them home, they're still firm enough to not have bruised too easily, but then they're pretty much ready to eat the day or two later. Now, the growers are going to have some that are more ripe than others, and they should be able to tell you that.
Well, I was going to say, what if we just ask you to pick out? I mean, you're the guy who knows the tomatoes.
We would appreciate it, and we want you to come back, so we're going to give you good advice.
Now, back to our own garden. What if some of the tomatoes that we have are not quite ripe? We've taken them off the vine for one reason or another. They've fallen off the vine, been knocked off the vine, but they're not quite ripe. What's the best way to bring them along?
Just on the countertop, dry and constant temperature. Just on a countertop. If they're far enough along, they'll ripen nicely. If they were not far enough along, they won't. But just keep them right there. You can watch at them and look forward to eating them.
And what about that thing about putting them in a brown paper bag and shutting it and even putting a banana in there for the ethylene? Is there anything to that?
Sure, there is. It will ripen faster because of the ethylene, and the paper bag holds it. So yes, if you're really wanting that first one or whatever, go. That does work, and feel free to.
Well, I for one cannot wait for that first bacon, lettuce, and tomato and basil sandwich coming up with good mayo. Very important.
I hear you. My father-in-law, who's a cattleman, started Elmwood Stock Farm. He will only eat cheeseburgers when black creme tomatoes are ripe.
My kind of cheeseburger eater.
There you go. There you go.
All right, Max Stone, thank you so much. We appreciate your time, and we'll stop by the Elmwood Stock Farm table when next at the farmer's market.
Well, great. Hope to see you, and appreciate the opportunity to visit, and appreciate your show.
You bet. Thank you very much. Appreciate that, Max. Thanks. At some point this summer, maybe fix yourself a great sandwich or a salad featuring one of these farm or homegrown tomatoes. Then settle in out on the porch or the deck or the front lawn, and if you've set out the right kind of feeder, enjoy the show put on by a fascinating creature, the hummingbird. WEKU's Samantha Morrill.
Of the hundreds of hummingbird species, Kentucky only gets the chance to play host to one of them, the ruby-throated hummingbird. Dr. Gary Richeson is a professor of biological sciences at Eastern Kentucky University. Richeson says the male ruby throats are smaller than the females, weighing just 3 grams compared to the females, 3.5 grams. But it's easier than that to tell them apart.
The back is iridescent green, and the underparts are white. On the female, all white, all the way down from the throat to the belly. But then, of course, males have the ruby throat, the really brightly red-colored throat.
While some hummingbird species in the tropics feed from and pollinate specific types of flowers, Richeson says the ruby throat variety aren't the most reliable pollinators.
Because if they pick up pollen from one plant, one species, and then go forage on a different species, then obviously no pollination occurs. And so they do provide some pollination service, but they're probably in this area not as important as things like bees.
Competent pollinators or not, when it comes to attracting hummingbirds to your yard, Richeson says a traditional hummingbird feeder will do the trick.
If you put up a feeder that's brightly colored, maybe has some red coloration, which seems to attract ruby throats, and then you put some sugar water in that, it's really easy to make at home. You just take about one cup of sugar and 4 cups of water and mix that until the sugar dissolves, and hummingbirds love that.
Picking up a big red bottle of hummingbird food at the store might seem simpler, but Richeson says that's not a great idea for a couple of reasons.
Certainly the food coloring is totally, totally unnecessary, and it can't be good for the birds. So I would not buy that colored sugar water in stores. It's way overpriced, It is just so much easier to mix your own at home with just sugar and water.
Hummingbirds don't live on sugar water alone, though. Some stores sell smaller bottles of nutrient supplements. Again, Richeson says those are unnecessary.
Unbeknownst, perhaps, to many people is that hummingbirds spend part of the day hunting. They feed on small insects, mosquitoes, gnats, fruit flies, small spiders, and they get all the nutrients, the protein, and so on that they need from eating those insects.
You may have heard that you need to take down your feeder before it gets too cold, otherwise hummingbirds won't leave for the winter. Richeson says,
no, that's an old wives' tale. They do stay late sometimes. Most hummingbirds have left Kentucky by mid to late September, but even if you keep your feeders out, the hummingbirds will leave. They have this instinctive innate drive to migrate, and so there's no way you can induce a ruby throat to stay in Kentucky for the winter.
Finally, when it comes to hummingbird feeders, Richeson says it's important to take them down once a week.
When you've got that high sugar concentration in there, you can get growth of mold bacteria. And so even if the hummingbird feeders aren't empty, if they've been out for a week or so, then you should bring them in and clean them and put in some fresh. That's healthier for the birds.
There's more than one way you can help protect Kentucky's hummingbird population. Just sit back and enjoy a nice, bird-safe cup of coffee. Many hummingbird species migrate to South America in the winter, where there are lots of coffee plantations. Some of them are shaded coffee farms, and others are sunny coffee farms. The Smithsonian's National Zoo and Conservation Biology Institute created a bird-safe seal that it grants to shade coffee growers.
Because in these shade coffee farms, what the farmers do is that they leave some of the natural vegetation, some of the regular trees, the native trees and shrubs. They don't clear everything out. And so that allows the birds to still have some usable habitat.
Richeson says the bird-safe coffee farms benefit not just hummingbirds, but also some other bird species we may see this spring and summer, like warblers. Richeson says we should also be on the lookout for rose-breasted grosbeaks and orioles.
This is really kind of a favorite time of year for bird watchers because every day you've got new species returning from their wintering areas and either passing through Kentucky to areas further north where they breed or coming into Kentucky where they will be breeding this summer.
I'm Samantha Morrill in Richmond.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Mike Savage, executive producer, Wendy Barnett, producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on air, online, and on mobile at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Want to suggest an interview or a topic? You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.